Everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors this week. A brand new sponsor, which we're big fans of. It's called WP, as in WordPress, Migrate DB Pro. The URL is at deliciousbrains.com, but go to the URL bit.ly/WPMDBPro. Bit.ly, WPMDBPro. You get it. I'll put it in the show notes. It is a tool for keeping your databases in sync on WordPress, and we'll tell you how awesome it is later in the show. And Environments for Humans, whose big summer event is the CSS Summit. Go to cssummit.com to learn about it. Use the coupon code SHOPTALK for 20% off. We'll tell you more about that later in the show, too. But for now, let's kick things off.
Hello, hello, dear listener. Did you wear your flak jacket today? Because this is a rapid fire episode, Chris.
That's right, everybody. We try to do these once in a while. If you're a longtime listener, I'm sure you're aware of it. We'll probably not do the 3-minute thing this time. We'll do it every once in a while because that's just kind of fun, because we can get through a lot of questions when we do it that way. But even so, we have no guests, no drama, no question, or we have questions. We don't have anything except for questions. We're just going to get right into the questions. Tingle down my back.
And I think we owe TLC some money for that, or Queen Latifah.
Wasn't she in TLC?
I don't know. Anyhow, so without further ado, shall we just get into it, Chris? Here we go.
Tender loving care. Yeah, do it.
Patrick Skozinski writes in and says, I recently ran the W3C markup validation tool on one of my WordPress sites. You see where this is going. I was amazed to see how many errors came up. I was able to fix some of the markup errors easily. However, others will not seem to go away. I think it has something to do with the doc type I'm using, parentheses strict. Do you have any suggestions for validating my markup? Is it really that important to make sure there are no errors at all? For reference, the website I'm working on is, and I won't say the URL, but yeah, working on a website and it's not validating for strict. Chris?
It both doesn't matter and does matter a little bit. It doesn't matter, because if your website looks fine and it works fine in all browsers and you know it because you test in all browsers and you're fine and your client isn't reporting any problems and all that stuff, no, it doesn't matter. You're just validating it for the sake of validating it. No, it doesn't matter. Once in a while, it might be kind of a good idea to run it through there and just see what's up. Just like, oh, crap, I didn't close a div. Maybe it's not causing any problems, but you should probably close that div because it's unclosed and that sucks. And the validator can help find you something, problem like that. If you're actually having a problem and you have no idea why it's rendering so weird, maybe it's a good idea to run it through the validator and just see if you have any unclosed tags or weird attributes or something that's wrong like that. The validator can be a tool like that. If you see a bunch of errors in there that you don't understand and you're not having any problems with it, screw it. It doesn't matter. It's not that big of a deal. We're not in the 90s or whatever now, where people put little badges at the bottom of their website that says that the site validates. Nobody cares about that anymore. Thank God. It's weird that you're saying you're using a strict doc type. What does that mean, Dave? Is that back in XML?
XHTML. Yeah, XHTML 1.0 strict.
So first of all, ditch that, because you might as well just be using the HTML5 doc type. There's really no reason why you shouldn't be these days, right?
Yeah, so if you switch it to XHTML 1.0 transitional, you're going to get, it's actually, he had 11 errors on his website, but now you only have 5 errors. So that's pretty good. Like, strict is what you would imagine. It's strict, right? It's here, I'll read some of them. Like, meta property OG colon locale. That's open graph for Facebook, right?
Yeah.
There is no property attribute in meta tags. Fail. You know, there is no source attribute in iframes.
This is exactly the kind of error that you shouldn't care about. A meta tag for Facebook, you're probably trying to do the right thing there. And so when somebody posts this thing on Facebook, it like has the right kind of like description and thumbnail and stuff like that. Who gives a hoot if the W3C friggin' doesn't like that tag? I don't care.
Yeah. There's no height. You're getting three errors for no height, width, and allow full screen at and frame border. That's four
attributes. Some iframe or something.
In an iframe. So, like, you just had a YouTube embed code or something like that that had all these. Or it's probably Vimeo or something like that. And, like, yeah, it totally just – you're getting docked for stuff that is totally fine in HTML5. Yeah. So I would – yeah, dude, I would change your doc type immediately. But I think so there are like –
it's funny. People kind of get off on using strict mode in JavaScript. Why not strict mode in HTML, you know? Because you should use the HTML5 one is why. I guess.
Yeah, well, HTML, the validator was awesome, right? Like, you had to check your site against it and put the badge on your site, like you said. But then HTML5 came around, and the validator couldn't keep up because HTML5 is really tolerant. Like, XHTML is pretty strict. Like, it has a lot of rules. Like, you actually have to close tags. HTML kind of doesn't care, you know? But there is, like, a good web citizenry thing that you should be validating. And there's like a lot of accessibility things like you should be validating, but like for a long time, the validators couldn't keep up. So they kind of fell out of pace. They're pretty good again now, but they'll flag you for stuff that is kind of fine or a business decision or, you know, I don't know, like you used an embed tag.
Sure.
You get flagged. So I would read through it and see what you're failing on and just figure out why you're failing on it.
Good question, Patrick. I feel like that's legit, and I feel like we kind of covered it there. Have you seen the Philip Walton's? Definitely, probably Trent's brother, right? Philip Walton has this introducing HTML inspector. He's got this kind of JavaScript version of the validator, kind of, so you can run it like you could JS Hint or CSS Lint or whatever.
Okay,
I think it's neat. I kind of want to play around with it for CodePen just to so we can spot errors and point them out, kind of in line.
Because CodePen's like a teaching tool. I mean, right?
Yeah, like, or just like kind of just to make sure that the things that you write on there, I can just because we have the ability to do it, we should. You know, recently released inline preprocessor errors, and I find it just highly useful. So when I type a line and it's like referencing a variable that doesn't exist or something, I like that IDE thing where it's like, hey, buddy, wait, that's not defined. Like, I think that's useful and nice when you're writing code. So I think that might be cool to use this too, although I haven't played with it much. So I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. You know, that my favorite thing in Sublime is the, like, it'll draw a square around like a tag you haven't closed or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it'll kind of be like, meh, this is wonky.
Right.
I love that. And yeah, I mean, you should ideally, like, I guess back to Patrick's kind of question. It's like, ideally, like, your code editor has kind of warned you of any serious issues, sort of, you know?
That's true. Although it's a little tough sometimes because maybe you're working in WordPress, and you opened it in one file and close it in another.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, just know what's going wrong. And anyway, so when your client comes back to you and says, why am I not XHTML compatible? You say, well, because that's out of date. So, boom.
David F. asks, should I learn Haml or Emmet to speed up writing HTML? Now, that's the entire question. those are both interesting, useful things. You can go back and listen to the episode we had with Mr. Hamill himself, Hampton Catlin.
Hampton Catlin.
I don't know if the Hamill will speed up the writing of your HTML. It might a little bit because you don't have to, like, for example, write a closing tag. You just kind of do like – you would do like a percent sign H1 space header of my website, and that will translate then when it's pre-processed into an H1 with a closing tag around it. So you could get faster at it technically, but I wouldn't worry about saving keystrokes so much with Hamill. It's just kind of a more succinct thing to look at, I think.
Hamill might improve, like, because Hamill, right, you work one way on the tree. Like, you only go out. You don't really go back so much, you know? Yeah. You don't have to go all the way back to the left.
Like, it has some
sides.
Rails stuff in it. It looks a lot like Rails. And stuff, you might be comfortable in there. It's cool. I like writing in Hamill sometimes, but I don't know that you should, if your goal is speeding up your writing of HTML, that it's that big of a deal. Now, Emmet, on the other hand, is different. Emmet is just it's like macros in a lot of cases. It's so you can type something like UL and then like an arrow, you know, like the closing angle bracket or whatever. So UL and then pointing at LI times 3, right arrow A times 3 or something. And it will give you this an unordered list with 3 list items in it and a link within each one of those. And it'll have the href attribute already added to it because it knows that all anchors should have it. So that if you can get used to your fingers typing that, which mine have now, I'm totally love Emmet. You can get HTML mocked up really quickly. So when my fingers need like div ID page wrap or div class page wrap, I type dot page wrap tab every time now because I have it in Sublime, I have it in CodePen, I have it in everywhere that I write code. Emmet will then expand that immediately into the HTML of div class CodePen with the closing bracket and put the cursor in the middle of it. Now, Emmet really is about speeding up writing your HTML. It has some great stuff for CSS as well in it. For example, you can get lazy with how you type. Now, this is funny because we recently had Noah Stokes on, and he's like, you should, you know, have no code completion. And he's kind of had the opposite opinion of this. And, you know, I can see the value of that. But I know it in my head so well. Like, I'm not going to – like, if something will help me type position absolute, I know how to type that with my fingers. But if I can type, like, pause A, B, tab, just, like, lazily slop on my keyboard, and have it output position absolute. Awesome. And Emmet does that. Yeah. It has this called fuzzy search. So you just kind of like sloppily type out what you're trying to write, and it will kind of guess what you meant by that and expand it into the right CSS. It's really cool if you haven't seen it.
I just did table. I opened up CodePen. CodePen has Emmet, right?
All yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I did like table arrow in no spaces, table arrow TR times 5, arrow TD times 10, and I made like a 5-row, 10-column
table. It's super great for tables.
I mean, dude, like if I would learn that and just like, you know, it's a shortcut. It's a mathy shortcut, right? That's all it is. So I would learn Emmet. I think everyone should kind of, I don't know, have it, but don't depend on it, obviously. But how would you depend on it? You know, you're like...
It's just a shortcut. It's just useful.
It's just a shortcut.
It actually, its scope is a little wider than that, too. It has, like, key commands that it adds to editors that are also very useful. Like wherever my cursor is, I think it's, God, what... I wish I had them all memorized. And... D, I think. Yeah. Command D. You can try this in CodePen. So Dave was showing me a pen earlier. So are you on that pen right now? Your little Houston San Antonio one or whatever?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So
yeah.
Click on like voluptium or whatever, like one of those like lorem ipsum words in the middle of it. Put your cursor in there and then hit Command D. It'll select all the text inside that P tag, right?
Whoa.
And now Command D again, and it will grab the P tags also. Then hit Command-D again, and it will select all the text inside the div. Then hit Command-D again, and it will grab the div, too. It, like, expands usefulness outward. You know, like, it's hard to explain exactly, but it will select, like, what you're probably trying to select up the bubble, up the DOM tree, kind of. It's not the DOM, because it's just some text that you wrote, but it's pretty useful.
Yeah. And that's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of Vim nerdy. I don't know. I assume there's something in Vim that can do that. But that's from Emmett. Emmett does that. Yeah.
It's just like scope up, next level, next level. Yeah. Give me the next thing. That's handy. I didn't know about that.
Tips. I love this. Hot tips.
Hot tips here on the show.
So hopefully that was useful for you, David F. Now we have another question here from from Paul Redmond, and this is going to morph right into one of our sponsors, and that's why we're so happy to have this sponsor on the show, because, you'll see. Paul asks, do you know of any good tutorials or resources that explain how to set up a workflow for WordPress using GitHub for version control? I understand a little bit about the benefits of working with Git for static sites, but I was wondering if it's also possible to set up a good workflow for developing and tracking versions of WordPress sites in Git. How would you then? Let's stop there for a second. So, yeah, I mean, it's just to, I guess, inject another sponsor or something, cha-ching. But the stuff on CSS Tricks, the Lodge has tons of stuff about using Git and setting it up. And CSS Tricks is in WordPress. So, I have this whole video series that's very highly related to this. So, yes, that is a good tutorial if you're looking for a resource on that.
I would, I'm going to do some myth busting on you, Paul. So I understand the benefits about Git for static sites, and that's, true. It's really good for static sites. But, Git is used at, GitHub level for very dynamic sites. You know, GitHub is dynamic. It's not a static website, per se. So, kind of try to get your brain around actually Git is for really dynamic sites, even WordPress.
That's a good myth. I wasn't even aware that that's a myth. It's good. There's literally nothing on the web that's a bad idea to have on GitHub. It's for everything. As far as I know, I can't think of an example of something you shouldn't have that in version control, No, nothing.
Yeah. Well, private. Don't make your private stuff a public thing.
No, I mean, CodePen's on GitHub, but it's private,
Yeah, exactly.
It's not good for, images and stuff. I mean, not that you can't have images in there, but don't put, your Photoshop files in there. That's a good example. Because then every time you hit save on it, it's saves a copy, and it, balloons the size of your Git repo enormously. Okay. So
that's good. So WordPress, you're going to want to ignore your uploads folder. That's step one, right? So.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Because, keeping that in sync would be a little weird. Mm-hmm. Maybe not your whole content. No, but that's where your themes and plugins are, right? So you want to keep it. Depends. Some people just version control the theme. At Shop Talk, we just version control the whole thing. So if you need to.
We do the whole thing.
Yeah. So if you. Yeah, which might be weird. We should probably ignore the. But we don't actually use uploads all that much. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Total tangent. I do the whole thing. So I can upgrade WordPress locally and then just push it up when I deploy. Now, I know deployment is a whole different topic. We've talked about that a few times. It's worth a blog post because there's so many different ways that you can handle deployment. I know I've mentioned Beanstalk before, but there's some other, ones too. I'd say more modern, but I don't know. They all do the same thing. You give it your FTP credentials and it pushes it up for you. It's great. Anyway, then he goes on to say, how would you handle the database then? Okay, now this is the whole other topic, is that version control, Git, GitHub, whatever, they don't deal with your database at all. There's no feature in GitHub at all that handles your database. So how do you keep them in sync? The one answer to this question is, does it matter? Do you care? If you have a database that's even close, I don't need, in order to work on the ShopTalk site, for example, I don't need the exactly newest version of the database, it depends on what you're working on, but chances are I don't. It just doesn't matter. I can see what I'm doing with the data that's already there. And so I don't really need the database to be in sync all that much, but sometimes you do, for whatever reason you do. That's a little bit more complicated, right? Okay. One of the answers to this, then, this is literally, I'm not even kidding, the solution I've seen for it yet, is a plugin, and it's by this company called Delicious Brains. And so you can go to deliciousbrains.com/wp-migrate-dbpro. The name of it is WP Migrate DB Pro. And, I'm doing a sponsor spot here, but it's also the answer to this question. And again, that's the bit.ly link, bit.ly, and then WPM DB Pro, and then it will get to the, it'll go to the right one where we'll get some credit for you going to that link. not affiliate credit, but just, you know, like, so they can track it to make sure that sponsoring the show is a good idea, which it is. It's a plugin that you install on your local copy of WordPress, and you install it on your live copy of WordPress, so they're both there. And then it has just a really simple UI for which one do you want to do. Do you want to take the live site and kind of pipe it down to the local site, or do you want to take the local site and pipe it up to the main site? It goes HTTPS by default, so you're sending all this stuff encrypted, which is good, just in case, you know, you have, it's a if it's a secret site or whatever, but it works through over HTTPS as well. It gives you like a little key kind of deal, so that not anybody can just do this. If you accidentally like leave this activated or whatever, the URLs and stuff that it has to expose in order to do this, you know, there's like a secret key that nobody else will have, so they can't do it. So that's good. And it just does little bits at a time. It sees what it needs to, and it doesn't just export the entire database. It just, it knows what has changed since the last time you did it, and will send little bits down, little bite-sized chunks, whichever direction you want to head. And then, you know, and if it's only like a couple of blog posts that have changed or whatever, it happens just super fast. And then you're like, cool, it's synced now. Enjoy. I freaking love it. Yeah, what's up?
I'm also a client. I used it on ATX Web Show, another podcast I run for here in Austin. But it, like, I was afraid. I was like, okay, this is just going to wipe my database. Yeah. Right?
You should back up your database first if you're worried. You know,
always back up your database. But dude, it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
No problems. It was awesome. It's great.
There was actually one setting that I turned off, and I'm going to tell the people what it is, just because I feel like that will add more value to this a little bit. Let's see. I have to run some commands here, but this is valuable bit, I think. So I'm gonna do it. I use it on the CodePen blog because if there was a couple of cases where I really needed to have them both up to date. And you can just do it back and forth just all day, man. Zoop, 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 zoop. I'm going to log into my thing. Yeah, I love it. This is, and God, how many times has this question come up on Chop Talk Show? Just a zillion times.
A million and a half.
And now we have the answer to do it, which I really quite like. So do you settings, WP Migrate Pro, there's a migrate thing, and you can save a profile so you don't have to do the settings every single time. Which I think is cool. And then you just kind of pick that profile, which is what I'm doing here. There is like a, there's like find replace, right? So it looks through the database and finds any instances. In my case, I run the blog for CodePen on my local machine at blog.codepen.whatup, just because that's what I do. I just make that little URL in MAMP or whatever and just run it there. So when it goes through your database, it finds any instances of blog.codepen.io in my case and replaces it with .whatup. And I think there was another one in there that it would replace, or there was some other, there's some other thing like advanced options, replace GUIDs or whatever. That should be on, I guess, even though it replaces not doing that. There was two things it was finding replacing, and I just found that it worked great for me if I just had it replace just the URL only. I think I removed the second thing that was in there. Sorry that that wasn't as big of a reveal as I thought it was. But anyway, this thing just works perfectly, perfectly great for us. Look at this. If you open it up, I'm not going to see it. It's, I think it's if you already own it, you can buy it. Anyway, it's an awesome plugin. I'm going to use it at all my sites now. I haven't used it on CSS Tricks yet because the database is on the little bit on the enormous side, so I'm not sure how long it would take to roll. But definitely if it's a smallish kind of site or even medium, I'm sure it works really good. So that was a long sponsor spot, but thanks so much, WP Migrate DB Pro, for working it. You've solved a very big problem that a lot of people have with WordPress, and good on you for doing it. It is a
excellent!
It costs a few bucks. So, whatever. Deal.
Perfect. No, it's good. Worth every penny. So, all right. Next question is Mike M. calling in, says, I'm wondering if you know a way to synchronize breakpoint values between different assets. Here's an example. Let's say I'm using a SAS variable for small, medium, and large breakpoints, but I also want to listen for those breakpoints in JavaScript. I would have to set those breakpoints separately in two different places.
Right.
Is there a way to set the breakpoint values in some way so that both SAS and JS can reload them and use them, or great, so SAS question, and JS can load them in and use them? So,
well, SAS is weird to say. I mean, just, well, how about just CSS, you know? Actually, there is kind of a pretty funky little way that you can get SAS to talk to JavaScript, which I'm going to be having a little guest post about pretty soon. So watch for that. But it's more about like you need to write a media query that works in CSS, literally at media and then something like, you know, max width, min width, probably because min width queries are 400
pixels.
Right. So you have to write that. You have to literally write out at media min width 400 pixels. But in your JavaScript, you might want to react to that as well. You might want to use window.matchMedia or something, right? To use that same exact media query. Mm-hmm. But then you have to type it twice. Why isn't there some way where you can like reference a media query? And there just isn't, right? I mean, there isn't just a really super easy way to do this. It has been tossed around that maybe we should define a media query as a meta tag in the head of the document. And then your CSS could, you would name it, you know, you'd go like breakpoint and then it has a name of like Dave.
Like your
Dave.
Mama bear, papa bear.
Yeah. And then you put a value on that and that has the media query in it. And then your JavaScript knows that it's there somehow. And your CSS knows that it's there somehow. I don't know if that works with, you know, the downloading of assets and the rendering and the prefetching. And it seems like an elegant solution to me, but I don't know enough about the internals of browsers to know if that's an acceptable place to put that. I like the idea of it. But there is another way. There's a Jeremy Keith post about it. I'll have to Google it, where he does this, you know, he had this idea that you could, instead of using like match media, you would write the media query in CSS and you would change like the content of a pseudo element on like the body and set like the font family to something ridiculous like Mama Bear. And then, you know, then watch for the screen to change however you wish to do that, but probably with something like watching for window.onResize. And then do what is the JavaScript thing to like query the styles of a
document
element?
Get
computed style, something like that.
Computed style, yeah.
On that body element, and if that happens to equal Mama Bear, then you know that media query in CSS has then worked. And then you can be like, oh, cool. So that it gives you that way that you will only then have to write your media queries only in CSS and then use them in JavaScript as well. So it's a little hacky, but that's a way that you could go about it.
Mm-hmm. Because then you'd just have to like have like whatever Mama Bear show up or something like that.
Yeah.
But be hidden or something, you know.
Jeremy wrote about it and then didn't put a demo. His writing is so good. And I was like, dude, you got to demo it up. Duh. So I made the demo.
Move,
the demo.
Jeremy.
Previous shop talk show guest Jeremy Keith. There's a demo of it working on CSS tricks, which could be probably moved to CodePen.
Hey, Jeremy Keith. Pro tip: include a demo. See what I did there? I just told Jeremy Keith how to do his job. That was awesome. All right. Is that good? Did we answer it, Mike?
Yes, yeah, it's done.
I think so. All right, next question. Josh Dean writes in, whenever I use SVGs for background as a background image and then add background size property, the SVG in Firefox is blurry. I've tried tried fixing this several ways, including making the width and height of the SVG 100%, but that doesn't seem to work in every case. Have you ever run into this problem?
No, but I believe you.
Yeah, I believe you too. I don't really use SVGs as background images. That's just me, though. I mean, maybe I'd need to.
Can't you?
Like just patterns, I guess, would be very helpful.
It would, but the only way to do it is to link up the .svg file, which is fine, I guess. I've seen inline SVGs used as backgrounds before, which I guess probably involves a little zindexy stuff, right?
Sure, yeah.
I don't know, try that instead, I guess, or just wait, because it's... Okay, here's what I really want to tell you, though. If it's literally blurry, this should be a very easy thing to make a reduced test case for. Do that, and then report it. Because that's the kind of thing, like maybe they are not even aware of this, or maybe they are, but loosely, or that they don't think anybody cares, or whatever. It's very, for something that's this specific, I find that highly likely. And report it to their little bug tracker thing, which I'll put a link in the show notes to. remind myself to do that because I like to, you know, I know when I listen to podcasts, I'm like, shut up about the putting the link in the podcast. Nobody clicks those links. I think it's important that it's there. Okay.
That's important.
And because it will get better over time. if it's really a bug, it will get fixed over time. So,
yeah. My guess is it's probably a subpixel thing, and Firefox's subpixel, it's been historically really good, but it's probably just a subpixel thing. They're not prioritizing, or it has performance issues to go like that many subpixels on SVGs and background images, but squeaky wheel gets grease. So,
it's kind of unacceptable if that's the case. I mean, it's never okay to make anything blurry ever. That would be my general rule.
I don't understand why it's blurry. I mean, maybe there's some like snap to pixel stuff you could do.
Maybe, but you know how, like, I don't know if you use icon fonts a lot, but they're always a little beefy in Firefox. So maybe it's related.
Maybe it's their, what's that called?
It's anti-aliasing. Yeah. Perhaps.
Dang it, dude. All right. Well, hopefully it gets better. Work up a test case. Yeah. And then like send it in and then, yeah, make a code pen.
It looks like that you have to use the back. It's related to using the background size property too. So maybe you can avoid that too. Okay. Yeah. Tim. Yeah. Kaboom. Tim Schmalbert.
Shamalama.
Do you follow any specific style guides for personal/team coding? So, I don't know. Have we talked about style guides in a while? Style guides meaning, to me, not like a pattern library, not Bootstrap, not, you know, whatever these pattern new I.O. ones or whatever, but literally like, should you put a space before the brace? Do you use single line or multi-line style? Do you use tabs versus spaces, and how many spaces and how wide are the tab? Do you alphabetize your CSS selectors? Do you put like extraneous white space in parentheses in JavaScript? That type of thing, right? Like how does the code look? And they're usually trivial choices, and I don't mean trivial like not important, although I guess I kind of do. But like things that don't impact how the code will run so much as the understandability of it, the readability of it, the consistency of it. Do you have an agreed upon style between at Paravel? I don't know how many of you write code. All of you,
yeah,
though, right?
I mean, we all kind of touch it. I mean, it sort of ebbs and flows, you know. I think our main thing is we do SAS, right? We're kind of getting onto SAS. The main thing is rules on one rule per line, right? One property value per line. And then we did two space tabs. But
I know, I heard you're going four space.
Well, we worked with a client that had four space tabs, and so it was just kind of like, and then you use that for a while, and that looks normal, and then you're like, maybe I need to move that
way. I could be convinced, too. CodePen is all two space, and I'm a stickler about it just because I like consistency, so I'll literally make a commit which is kind of a faux pas sometimes, which is just because it looks like I made this big change to this file, but I really didn't. I just changed the spaces. Sorry, guys.
That's my favorite open source commit. Isn't it? It's 100% different.
Yeah, totally. Like,
changed it. Anyway.
Anyway, but now it's all really consistent. But now, you know what? If I could go back in time, I think the four spaces looks better, which might be blasphemy. But it really does like more, I don't know. There's a lot of code that hugs the left of the square window open, and it's like the left is highly more populated than the rest of it. It's just more emphatic of an indent and uses more of the page if you use four spaces, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of our thing. We do have like if you're just changing like a background image position or something like that on 100 different things, like a sprite sheet, we'll do something simple, you know, like one line and just do all that in one line. If it's like repeating and stuff like that. So
there's a thing to break every rule, especially if it's a selector that only changes one property and value. I feel like that's sometimes worthy of a one liner.
Mm-hmm. Nicholas.
Yeah. Nicholas Gallagher.
Nicholas Gallagher on GitHub has idiomatic CSS. And this may not be for you or your team exactly, but I found it to be a great start. I worked with a tech company recently, and we kind of established like a style guide for front end code, and found that to be very helpful. You know, the whole, like, how you're going to do a section in a comment block and how, you know, how you're going to organize your rules can actually help your team. You know, he does it like positioning, then display and box model stuff, and then all the other crap like background and font color and stuff.
Yeah. So, that's a great read.
It's a great read. That's exactly it, right? It's like in a book apart book. It's just like, yeah, this is how I want to write CSS. Mm-hmm. I love this.
I looked that up. There's a post on CSS Tricks that just rounds up different style guides, including that one. So mm-hmm. if you want to check out a bunch of different ones, I of course it ends up being one of those things where it's full of so much personal preference that you probably will pull things from different ones. We should almost have a thing where we like have the ones that we hate. I don't know, just because I've thought of one. I really don't like the one where you have to, where like you do a for loop or whatever, and you put the white space after the opening parentheses. I know some people just love that. I just can't stand it when there's like extra space and the inside of the parentheses thing. Ugh. Just bugs me.
You know what? Doesn't like, sorry, this is off topic. Doesn't JS Lint enforce like spaces in the bracket?
I hope not.
Croc.
I also have a SAS style guide I posted recently too that was about not, you know, rules, things that are very specific to SAS, like where should you put your extends? And I'm like, you should put those first because you really need to see if a particular class, you know, like don't bury it down in a block of crap. You really need to see if a class name extends some other class. That's really important, you know, and like, and then how else do you do it? How do you handle nesting? How do you handle includes? Like, how much nesting is too much nesting? And, you know, how do you organize your kind of global files and stuff? There's tons of that stuff. So if you're interested in SAS style guides, I wrote one of those up recently too. That's just kind of my opinions and how I like to roll with that kind of thing. You know what? I bet donut charts. I think they're super rad.
That one's not near loud enough.
I like donut charts. I think they're super rad.
There we go.
That's old.
So that's old, man.
Yeah.
Pulled it out.
I like
donut charts.
It's going up.
All right.
You know where I bet this type of topic will come up? What kind of event that will probably...
Chris, where can I find out like super nerdy CSS stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we're all getting off on talking about CSS. Let's say you wanted to talk about CSS for 3 straight days. Well, if that's your type of thing, people, you should go to cssummit.com. It'll redirect you to an Environments for Human site. Heck yeah. It's the 5th annual online conference, the CSS Summit. It's coming up really soon here. I think I know when this is going to air. Honestly, this is a rapid fire show. As you all know, we kind of record these in advance a little bit so that we never miss a week because we love you guys so much. I think you have a couple weeks when this airs. So make your decision now. It's July. What do you have?
Oh, like it's coming up quick. So register.
Exactly. Register. It's July 23rd, 24th, and 25th. It's 9 to 5. So it's an all day kind of thing. You can, and it's an online conference, meaning that you attend it from your browser. You can do it from anywhere in the world. All the best people are speaking at it, including Dave. Let me list some new people that I haven't listed to last time. Allison Wagner's been on the show. Scott Kellum. Have we had Scott on? We should get him on if we haven't. Laura Kalbag, who's been on the show. The State of SAS and Compass by Chris Epstein, which will be particularly interesting because he's going to be talking about SAS 3.3, which I just secretly talked to Chris today, which will be a few weeks ago when you listen to this. And he's going to give me the scoop on it for me to post on CSS Tricks, but all the stuff coming in it, which is super crazy.
Neighbors, animation wizard, Chris Rupel. He does Drupal conveniently, but he has a playground, CSS playground, dude.
You should go to this conference is the point.
Oh,
use coupon. Yeah.
Tab's bringing the info about CSS variables and conditionals.
Really?
Tab Atkins, mm-hmm. freaking standards writer. There I'll you
talk
go.
To him about
I'm
that.
Interested. I might get angry in that one.
<Let's> see.
Curious. I'm curious. Anyway.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, I have some opinions about that. Maybe we'll get him on the show again. We've never had a repeat guest, but if variables come out, we're going to have to talk about that. Anyway, they kind of are in some way, but like this, he's anyway. Let's not get into a rabbit hole about that. You should go to the CSS Summit, July 23rd, 24th, 25th. Use coupon code CHOPTALK for 20% off, and we'll see you there. It's going to be sweet. We'll see you there virtually online. It's an online conference.
Excellent.
Okay. Matt Poop Splat Soria, longtime listener of the show. Dude, he's in the chat room like every week. So writes in, I got a general question about HT access. I'm primarily a designer and front-end developer, and stuff like this is a bit out of my reach from my knowledge. So I was wondering if you had any advice for what should go into every HT access file. Do you have a standard that gets into every project? I heard talk about one included in the HTML5 boilerplate and took a look, but a lot of it didn't really mean anything to me. So I wasn't sure what to take, or should I just take it all? There you go.
Good question, Matt.
So Chris, you have a friend, Perishable.
Oh yeah. Book. Yeah. The HT access book. It's literally htaccessbook.com. Which is an entire book about HD access, which I believe may be the only of its kind, which is kind of amazing because it really is a language unto itself. I don't think that it shares syntax with like nothing. It's super weird. So that would be good. I'm sure he talks a lot about WordPress and stuff in it, just because he's a WordPress dude. In fact, he has another new book called The Tao of WordPress that just came out, so that you should look up that too if you're interested in a new WordPress book. So that's the book, but like, what about this like HTML5 boilerplate stuff?
I love the H5 BP HT access. It is my most favorite file on the internet. I have a crush on it, genuine, like, this one is so good. And what it does is it kind of, I'll walk you through it. So, like, all the stuff that doesn't matter to you for the most part is commented out. So, like, you don't even have to worry about that. It's not going to affect you. There may be some stuff you need to comment out, but it's really easy to find. So it has things about cross-domain AJAX request. So if you get like an error in your web inspector that's like cores not enabled, doesn't work. This is mostly
for other people when they're trying to access your site. So this is just kind of doing the right thing about setting your access control origin to star, because everybody in the world should do that because it's awesome.
Yeah. Ideally, anyone can use your JavaScript or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Cores images is enabled by default, so people can use your images on other websites like Tumblr or whatever. That's been a big problem recently. Like, people have like cores for images stopped working. Web fonts, it like allows you to use your web fonts, even on subdomain. It has some like things for like 404 rerouting, and that would be the only stuff I would maybe comment out, because your WordPress or whatever is probably doing that already.
Or Rails. It's very rare to have a site that doesn't have some kind of error handling or whatever.
Yeah, and then so it's got it'll do Chrome Frame, which is weird because Chrome Frame doesn't exist anymore.
Well, that should probably go. That's fine though.
That should go.
Serves the right content types for different files. That's all pretty useful. It looks like me and Dave are both scrolling it down at the same time.
Yeah. So like, did you remember to add audio MP4 and audio AUG support to your server? Probably not.
But if you don't do that, there are browsers that will choke on your audio elements. Because they'll have the wrong content type. And it's just, or maybe your server is configured to do this already. It may be a host level thing, but this will make sure that it's right, even if it's not. For example, like content compression and stuff, there's pretty much no reason ever not to gzip your assets as they get sent out over your server. This has a bunch of code to make sure that that happens. Now, it's a little heavy-handed-ish sometimes because it has a lot of like if stuff, and it has some like old school versions of it. So it makes sure that this is going to work no matter what kind of server you put it on. That's why it's like you shouldn't have to think about this too much. Now, Matt is like, there's a lot of stuff in here that I don't just understand. That's okay. If you grab this entire file and you put it at your web root, assuming you're using Apache server, it's not going to hurt anything. I mean, it might mess with your error handling or whatever. That's why Dave is like, worry about that one a little bit. But if you notice that, then just come in here. But if you don't notice anything, it's probably doing something cool that is helping you that you didn't even know that you should be doing, but now you are.
Check this out. It blocks access to hidden files and directories.
Boom. Nice. Yeah.
Like security. Like, this is the best file on the internet. And like, I encourage you, it probably looks like gobbledygook or whatever, gobbledygook. But like, just cruise through it. It's well documented and commented. And it's, it's like a love letter to me. It's so, because I hate this stuff. I quit being a server guy. I know enough. And I've like, whited out my whole server. Just
g-zipping stuff. The deflating stuff is so powerful. If you find out that you're not g-zipping and then you drop this in there and you are, you can speed up your website a ton. And it's not only just g-zipping, like, but it's access control too. It's telling your browser to hold on to files, or telling the browser that asks your server for files, like, hey, hold on to my CSS for a year. Mm-hmm. Now, that can be a little tricky, too, because then all of a sudden you go update the CSS on your site and somebody else pulls it, and they're like, I don't see it. And you're like, why now? Why isn't it viewing my new CSS? That's another thing to be aware of, that then cache busting is on you, so that when you push up a new version of your CSS file, you should probably at least put a query string on the end of it that says, oh, this is version 2.2 now or whatever, and it'll bust that cache for you. But the speed that you get from caching like this is enormous. Imagine, going from page to page to page on your site and not having to re-download those assets. Very powerful. Okay, yep. That was a tangent.
Use it.
Don't necessarily care too much that you don't. Yeah.
If you're confused, read through it. So that's all. Whoa, the soundboard turned off, guys. This is serious. Here we go. Hey, next question. I'll read it, I guess. Eric Royale, I have a question for you. What is the best way to create column layouts in CSS? I recently bought a book that used tables to create layouts, but I know that sucks. And it does. I love floats and positioning, but I face a little difficulty using them. CSS3 Flexbox is really great. Is a really great one and easy, but that is not supported in older browsers, and my clients' websites are mostly used by people using IE9, less than IE9. I am currently using a grid system, but don't like using one, so what do you think is the best and easiest way? Christopher.
Yeah, okay, so what's the best way to create column layouts in CSS? I'm interested in the book that you bought that says to use tables. It could be a really old book. You like went to a garage sale or something and got some old school book that was explaining it. Or it might be, we should get her on the show because she's super nice. I think Rachel Andrew is super cool. Have you ever met Rachel Andrew? She's from the UK, yeah. Works on Perch or whatever. She is great. She also has a book, though, called... and this was, what year did this come out? I can't remember, but it's called Everything You Know About CSS is Wrong, and I think it was published through SitePoint. And it was all about display table. It was about not using literally tables, but it was about making things table layout. And I kind of don't like it. Sorry, Rachel. I feel like just because you as soon as you make something display like a table, who cares what the tag was in your HTML that made it that way? It still has all of the problems that table layouts have. It's like, okay, well, now try to switch two columns around. Well, you have to switch the source order then. That's the kind of the problem with tables, is that they're very source order dependent and stuff. Who cares if it's a div tag or a TD tag? They still have the same problems. And it feels kind of neat, and maybe Rachel would disagree with me on this and can provide her background on it. I actually don't have that book, I can't remember, but the deal is it feels a little good to write like div class column you know, or whatever. Like, it feels a little more semantic or less bad because you're not actually using a table, but you just made a display table. You're like, yeah.
So I like display table. For me, it's like, I'm like, yes, it's going to be like the best, my savior. And then it just like fails on me hard, and it's hard to like fix, you know. The thing about display table is like, once you set like a row of divs to display table, they are all table cells. Like, you can't say, but not this one. So like in responsive settings, it doesn't really work that super rad.
Right.
So I guess I'm saying, like, I think your post on how you do grids on CSS Tricks is probably the best way, right? I mean, that's like, if you want like easy getting into like how you're going to do a layout, man, I think that one's it, right?
It's IE 8 up, though, my particular post on grids, because it relies on box sizing border box. But the idea is, if you can rely on that, which I'm a huge, huge proponent of it, as you all know, I'm sure, that you should just do universal selector, we're still at the point where you should probably both use WebKit and Moz, but then do box sizing border box so that every single element uses the box model, in which that when you set a width, it is that width. And if you set a border, it doesn't matter. It comes out of the inside of that width. If you set a padding, it comes out of the inside of that width. That makes the math really, really easy for columns then. So let's say you want a four-column grid. You put four divs in there. You know, maybe you use some kind of crappy class name called like column one quarter. And you set column one quarter to be width 25% and float left, and you have a grid that is perfectly four columns. And in my post, I take it a little bit further, and I use kind of padding on the right side of each one of those columns, and then padding on the left side of the parent column, and they all shrink at the same little amount or whatever, so they're all the same size except for that. You know, that now you have gutters in there. That's pretty easy. It has its shortcomings. It's not necessarily perfect, but I use that almost all the time when I make a grid because it's really, really easy. And I think supporting IE8 and up for a lot of people is reality these days. So that's a pretty good way to go about it. I've seen some cool. Did you see that thing going around recently about using display justify. Inline Bok and text align justify? Yeah, that's pretty cool too. I mean, it doesn't give you really pixel solid, really great control over the gutters because it's just kind of like what's ever left over, you get what you get kind of thing. But I think it's still pretty cool.
The like classic way, I think, Eric, is float, right? So float, it's div class container. You're going to need this container because you need to add a clear fix to it because we're about to float some stuff into it. And then in container, you have div class left. And then in your CSS, you know, that's like float left. And it's is width whatever, 30 or whatever, 66%. And then you have div class right after that. And that can either be float left or float right. You decide. I actually float everything left on purpose, but just so I have less variables going on. But,
you know, that's both good and bad. And so that's an interesting little mini topic anyway.
Yeah. But you set that to like width 33%. And then, and like that, and basically you just kind of do those columns like that. And it's not going to be awesome like Flexbox or whatever, but it doesn't sound like you need to be super awesome if your clients are IE8 and below or whatever. So that would be that's how I'd approach it. So, bam.
I like it. You know, and then just not to totally tangent this out, but, and Flexbox is going to be the greatest thing that's ever happened, and you'll love it, and that's going to be sweet. I have a post, my recent post on the Google Hangouts talks about like some of the really cool things you can do with that Flexbox makes easy. And I thought I would talk about it just for a minute, just because the Flexbox just kind of got extra cool this week, I feel like. IE 10, which is, of course, everybody knows is out and supports a fairly new version of the syntax behind a ie.ms. There's some developer previews of IE11. It has the latest version of it unprefixed. Awesome. Firefox just dropped it in 22, which releases today, maybe, or maybe the end of this week. Has the new version of it unprefixed. Chrome supports the newest stuff behind WebKit in 30, going unprefixed. Safari 7 has all the latest stuff. Or it has the old version at Dash WebKit, but 7.0, which people are seeing now because of the WWDC and whatever. Safari 7 desktop supports all the newest stuff, but under Dash WebKit, but whatever, that's still, at least it's there. Opera 15 is going to have it because it's Blink now. iOS 7 has all the newest stuff. Oh my God, can you believe it? They totally do in 7.0, but it's under Dash WebKit, but that's okay. BlackBerry 10 has all the latest stuff, but under Dash WebKit, also still fine. The only holdout is Android, but you assume isn't there going to be a 4.3 soon? There's got to be, or a 5 or something? Or is Android the worst?
Android's actually going Chrome, right? I mean,
probably.
From here on out, isn't it? At least all my new Androids are, but I think so.
But like stock and 4.2 or whatever, but at least it has the old school Cinder Signal WebKit. Anyway, Flexbox is like looking really good, you guys.
Looking good.
Yeah, I mean, the really big, what are the worst things that can happen with Flexbox? IE9, that's a problem. But, you know, if you can kill it, you can kill it. And then nothing, I guess.
And it's just a tube of content at that point. And my guess is you'd only have to float a few things, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to talk about generically. But Flexbox is like, remember I said about, I don't know, I think I said 6 months ago at the most, Flexbox will be a year. I bet I was right on.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
So when are you going to put CSS tricks in Flexbox?
I'll do it. I'll do it the next time, I promise. I would like to
do it next week.
Well, the next redesign or whatever, which is coming. It's not going to be a big... This is not set in stone. But my next CSS tricks thing is going to be... There'll be a little aesthetic tweaks and stuff, but it's not going to be as aesthetic as it is just really beefing out the functionality of the stuff that you'll be able to do on it. Like tying in the forums better with the Lodge stuff, with the commenting. And I'm going to wikiize some areas, I hope, and I'm going to have editable comments. And I got this big list of like just beefing up the functionality of it. Anyway, that was a tangent. Let's do some more questions.
Next question. Try Nguyen or Win, or yes, I nailed it. Is in order to use M and Rembrandt, I declare HTML font size 62.5% so that root size is 10 pixels. This allows me to do some mathematical calculations for faster. For example, 15 pixel font size can be declared as 1.5 rem.
Right.
However, this doesn't work when it comes to using M in media queries. I've noticed that these work correctly. I have to revert it back to a default 16 pixels. So do I use min width 1000 pixels and be consistent with min width?
Wasn't there a big thread about this on the accessibility project about using M media queries and what's up with these things recently? And Try is just saying it's weird because my M based media queries seem to be not based on this alteration I've done to font size. They seem to always be based on 16 pixels. What's up with that? Number one, and like because of this inconsistency, should I just do pixel media queries, or am I shooting myself in the foot, or what?
Yeah. So right now, M and rem based media queries are based off of a thing that you can't touch or whatever. It's like the browser's setting. So it's always going to be 16 pixels. So like right now the browser's dividing by 16, whatever your pixel value is.
Is that for rem and m?
I think so. And there used to be an advantage for like accessibility. Like if you hit command plus, M's would resize or whatever, and M's would resize and pixels wouldn't. So pixels would just zoom in and things would suck.
That was a bug, you know? And it's fixed now, right?
It's fixed now. So like, the advantage for M's and media queries is actually kind of gone, for right. some parts. The only way you want to use them, and this is how I still use them, is actually for like, I base all my content off of M's and I want to break on content less like pixel values. But I could switch to pixels as well. I can break on content, but I think in like, typographical measures and stuff like that. And so that's just me. But back to the like 62.5% trick. I'm not a fan, but I understand why you're doing it.
I used to think, I think it was a transitional, wasn't it a transitional idea? Because everybody used to use pixels. I mean, even if it wasn't cool back in the day, the vast majority of people writing CSS were sizing fonts in pixels because that's what we had available to us. Then, you know, and then some people were like, well, that sucks because they don't resize in IE and stuff. Those kind of days are over a little bit. The thing is, people had in their mind what 15 pixels looked like, and they wanted to keep doing that. They didn't want to have a paradigm shift in their brain or whatever. So they're like, if we use the 16.5 trick, I don't have to change how I think about fonts. I can just use 1.5 instead of 15, and it's the same thing now. So I can like cheat and make it easier.
I'm relative, but not.
Yeah, but yeah. I think that was a weird phase, and I feel like maybe the new designers coming up these days are going to think about font sizing and pixels less just because there are so many advantages to using relative pixel sizes that it's like, what does it matter? Does your mind really think about 15 pixels? Well, it doesn't think about the physical pixels buried in your screen because that's irrelevant these days. That's different from screen to screen to screen to screen. 15 pixels doesn't actually mean anything. It's totally arbitrary to begin with. Why don't you just start thinking in relative units anyway and just roll with that, you know, and just make sure that your mind knows about what 1.1 rem looks like and 1.2 rem looks like. You might as well. And I feel like rem is just straight up better. Just the fact that m's cascade on each other, I feel like is almost always obnoxious. And that rem is just a better unit for font size, kind of period. And just use rems. And I know there was, I think rems and media queries had a little bit less, like they didn't work at some point.
Didn't work, and now they do, and now it, but yeah, I think this was like a transition thing, and yeah, I tend to like keep the body size at 100% for like accessibility things, you know, like let's say some browser comes out and it's just for people with low vision, and it's like I override the font size, or my default font size, my 100% equals 50 pixels. Well, like you want to make sure you're not like trying to shrink that down because somebody downloaded that browser for a reason or whatever. These are hypothetical, but so they don't hold much water. But I just try to like keep it as baseline and then modify off of that baseline. Yep. Hopefully that helps. Try
just
hopefully.
Embrace the. I even use font size medium and font size large and stuff just to embrace the arbitrariness of it. Okay. Mr. Rene Ruiz asks, in one of your previous episodes, you talked a little bit about Nginx. I was hoping you could talk more about that. In the little that I read, it seems like it's much faster than Apache. But are there any catches, or is it a no-brainer to switch from Apache? Okay. I don't know a lot about this, but maybe you started out.
Okay, so Nginx it's a proxy, or can be a proxy. And it was developed by Russians, so you know it's really good. It's scrappy. It's good in a fight. What Nginx can do is it can take in like 1,000 requests a second or more. Like, so if I'm requesting 100 images from you, Nginx is like, got it, no problem. And so you sit that in front of Apache, right? And Nginx is going to try to like negotiate with Apache. That's kind of where it really shines or whatever.
So it's not always a replacement for Apache, right? They can run together?
Yeah, they run together like side by side. But you can also run like, I believe you can run Nginx just by itself, right? It's just like a lightweight server. And yeah, you can run it, you know, and so it's just going to basically act like Apache, but there might be like a few different differences that you're not expecting. And Apache powers like whatever, 80 or 90% of the web. So,
I had some problems on CSS Tricks recently, performance wise, that I was getting some help from Media Temple on, and one of their kind of temporary solutions was to put Nginx in front of it, and do caching through Nginx, so Nginx can do caching. Like, if this URL was requested, then the next time it gets requested, just serve them the exact same thing that I asked last time. It has this kind of thing. And that's interesting because it's, you know, that's kind of what something like W3 Total Cache does, only it like kind of saves an HTML file literally on the disk that it serves up, I think.
Yeah. That might be something like Varnish as well. Like, right. That's another like...
That gets tricky because like, what about logged in users, you know, like we had to kind of turn it off for people with certain cookies because, you know, they like post something on the forums and then refresh the page. They're like, what the heck? Where's my thing? You know, and updating stuff. You have to be really careful about that type of caching to make sure people, you know, see good content and stuff, but they definitely can work together. And then we ended up with some really weird problems with it not passing the right, you know, because we were talked about htaccess earlier. And stuff like setting the right headers for files. One of the things you really have to do for at FontFace in Firefox is make sure that they have the right cross-domain headers if you're going to then host those FontFace files on a CDN, which I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that cross-origin header set correctly, it will not work, you know, when you request it from the CDN then. And my CDN is really good. Like, when it asks for the file for the first time and caches it on the CDN, it will grab those the headers, and it will use the headers that are set on the server on the CDN as well.
Mm-hmm.
It just, it was weird. And Nginx was kind of like not passing along the header correctly. And then after like tons of work, we found out that it was actually setting the access control origin header twice. And when it has access to control on there twice with the star, even that would fail in Firefox. I'm like, oh god, good call, guys. It's set twice identically, and that's a fail. Anyway, I don't know. I was going off with this, but like Nginx and Apache don't have to be mutually exclusive. Maybe. Do you have any more to say about Nginx?
One thing that's cool about Nginx is it's kind of looks like a JSON file that you configure it with, you know, and that's really cool. But the way you configure it is a little different, right? Like, you have to like kind of burrow into your server. You can't just drop a htaccess file in your root directory. You have to kind of burrow into your server and set these settings kind of over the command line and stuff. So be prepared for that, you know. But I mean, try to get Nginx set up, you know, ideally just...
It is a speed thing, right? That's why you would do it, because it's...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because it's basically like it's an operator, if you think about it that way. And then and it can handle so much more. Or it's like a mail sorter. So not like email, but like just like somebody in a room. He's just like, boom, 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 boom. Gotta, you know, he's kind of amped up. A feisty Russian. Is that okay to say? Oh, well. Sorry, Russian listeners. Next. This is the last question we got here. Jason Dreisener writes in and says, could you talk about using Normalize with Compass on SAS? What is your workflow for getting started?
SAS on Compass?
I think, like, do you just drop in normalize.scss and...
Well, Normalize, I don't think Normalize has an SCSS version of itself, but it doesn't matter because you just rename it SCSS because all CSS is valid SCSS.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's it, you know? And then, which is great because the actual normalize.css file is so loaded with comments explaining about what it's doing that would be totally impractical to link up like it is. So using it is automatically cooler with SAS, assuming that you're outputting compressed, because it's going to remove all that stuff when you use it, when you include it in another file and output it. So that's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think there's much to it other than that.
Yeah. Like, somebody asked me recently, and this is a question we've talked about before, but like, how do I work with Normalize, you know, and do I just drop it in like a CSS reset? And the answer to that is no, you kind of work with and around Normalize, like you integrate it. That's like that's your boilerplate for the project, right?
Yes.
And so I think in the past show, I was like, hey, and I'm sure you listened to it because you listened to all of them, right, Jason? But I was like, it would be cool if these were already broken up into SAS modules, like that I kind of already use, like typography or something like that. And somebody was like, yeah, I made that repo and it's up on GitHub, and I don't know the URL right now, but like, I'm sure you can just say like GitHub normalize SAS or whatever and start getting have a already pre-broken up repo. So I think that's kind of the way to go. I realized today normalize adds padding top or margin top to paragraphs, and I hate it.
Well, that's that, but don't it's that's then the remove default. It. Then
yeah,
remove
exactly.
It. Here's the, I've probably explained this before, but and maybe I don't have it right or whatever, but this is, I still love normalize. If there's something declared in normalize, it's because it has to be, because there's some problem with it cross browser. So they declare it there in which to normalize it across browsers. It's not the same as a reset. You shouldn't include normalize and then go through and write a typography file, which then overrides what's written in normalize. That's not the right idea here. It's not, that's what you would do with a reset, I think. That's not what you should do here. Yeah. It's like a guide to tell you what kind of things really need to be set because there's problems with them cross browser. So you should go and look at the paragraph, and it says, oh, it's adding paragraph top, 10 picks top to paragraphs. I hate that too. That's ridiculous. But it's there because it needs to be for some reason. So instead, you should set paragraph and you should use the shorthand for it so that you reset all the sides of paragraph of padding. And even if it's padding zero, which is what I would do probably, then do that. But at least it's in there, you know, and then change it. What's hard to think about here is then all like, well, what if normalize updates? Well, you know, then you're up. Wood creek without a paddle, yeah. Or whatever. Not really. It's not that big of a deal, you know. It's just like, oh, go look at the change log and see kind of what changed or whatever. It's not that big of a deal, really. It's probably something somewhat trivial. It's not this huge bug in normalize. It's mature enough of a project for that. But then go through the entire normalize and see what it sets and be like, is this right for my project? If it's not, I'll change it there. But I know that I need to because there's a problem. I'm feeling drilling this into the ground, but I'm like, that's what normalize is. That's how you use it.
Yep. So hopefully that's good. Yeah, hopefully that helps. Just don't use it like a reset. I think that's the key, right?
Or like Twitter Bootstrap or whatever. It's not this style thing that you should use on your website. Although I'm probably doing the world a disservice by making it one of the things that you can choose as an alternative to a reset on CodePen, because we don't really give you access to it. You'll have to use it like a reset on CodePen and overwrite styles like that. But in an actual project, yeah. You would actually alter normalize the file itself to be how you want it to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just a guide to tell you what you need to do. Okay. All right.
It's a boilerplate. Boilerplate. Here we go. Boom. Well, Chris, I got some sad news. After like a couple hours of rapid fire, we're done. So, thanks everyone for listening. That gunshot is for you.
Some of us told us they didn't like the gunfire one time. It was too, I don't know. It doesn't make us... Okay, let's not go there. Anyway, thank you guys for listening very much. The morning zoo. Dave does the ending part usually about the rating us in iTunes and
rate us in iTunes, follow us on Twitter, blah blah blah, buy a t-shirt. You know the drill.
You should buy a t-shirt. Anyway, chopdogshow.com.
Ta-da.